Thanks, Katie, and thank you all for being here today. I'm going to pick up on some of the points that Amanda introduced during her discussion about to delve a little bit deeper into some of the vaccine policy creation discussion. It's been a very active year and a half as far as that's concerned. And I can't help but think, I mean, in part, one of the reasons I thought this was a very interesting topic to tackle is that role that legislators and the role that elected officials have in shaping the narrative and shaping the discussion around vaccines, I think is something that we need to attend to, but it tends to be overlooked when in reality, it's the vaccine laws that we have and the vaccine policies that we are promoting that really kind of set the environment up where all these conversations end up taking place. One of the things that we do find, as was just seen in Jiaoli's presentation, is a concept I can't help but think about, which is an old phrase that the trust arrives on foot and leaves on horseback. And so one of the things that we tend to see in these conversations is that we are doing a lot to try to incrementally build up trust, but it's like it can take just one event and it can backslide support for policies, for best practices. And so what I want to do is give a little bit of background on the policymaking process as it pertains to vaccinations, and then talk a little bit about what's been going on in the states over the last over the last year and a half, and talk about how the incident and the outbreak arising out of the Disneyland outbreak, and then all of the legislative activity and the public discussion that surrounded that, and raise some observations and some concerns about the way that discussion does not follow the best practices that Amanda was talking about as far as vaccine communication is concerned. But it does also link in, I think, to some other goals and objectives that we often do see in public health, namely the concept of denormalizing certain types of behaviors. So just a little bit of quick background on just a really brief public health law 101 kind of a thing. The way that we in the United States protect against vaccine-preventable illness is through laws that require proof of vaccination upon entry into school systems and into publicly licensed daycare facilities. The reason that we have this done is it's done through state laws. The reason it's done at the state level has to do with constitutional powers that were given to the states under the 10th Amendment of the Bill of Rights, which says that any power that the federal government doesn't explicitly give to itself, it is reserved for the states. So states have what's known as a police power, which is the power to protect. It's not just police officers and public protection and, you know, the public safety perspective, but states are given a power, it's a traditional power that comes from English law, to protect the health, welfare, safety, and morals of its citizens. And states are given, when they decide how they want to construct their laws to protect the public's health, they're given great deference by any reviewing court that might look at the way that they wish to approach these things. Under the Constitution and under the interpretation that the Supreme Court has given over the last 110 years about vaccine law, states are under no obligation to offer exemptions, at least as far as the kind of non-medical exemptions that Amanda talked about, because they can prioritize protecting the common good and protecting the public's health over any individual's wishes or desires as far as their personal health and safety is concerned. Because again, what we're talking about infectious disease control, we are talking about a medical treatment as far as that individual getting a shot or getting the immunization. But we're also talking about a public health, a community benefit, which is the herd immunity protection that we are given by having a highly vaccinated population. So as was stated earlier, the way that states, if they do decide to offer an exemption, and again, it is an option, but and most states do, for political reasons, offer some form of vaccine exemptions. Most states do offer either a religious and or a what's known as a personal belief or philosophical exemption. What we found over the years as far as usage of these exemptions are concerned is that religious exemptions tend to be more narrowly drawn. It tends to focus and to appeal to a narrower population than when you have available a personal belief exemption. And if you look at the statistics about usage of these exemptions, states that have personal belief exemptions tend to see, on average, 2.5 times more families deciding to opt out of one or several of the vaccinations than states that have a narrower religious exemption. And we'll talk a little bit more in a minute about this is a very broad brush. I'll take a couple of finer brushes to the discussion in a minute, as far as the many different ways that these laws can be adjusted to be more favorable or less favorable toward opting out of vaccination. As was discussed earlier, what we see is that it's still a fairly small percentage of families are choosing to opt out of vaccinations overall. This is the 2014-15 map of children entering into kindergartens who have decided to opt out of, whose families decided to have them opt out of vaccinations. And the highest percentages are just over 4% of children entering schools. As Amanda talked about, this is a bit deceptive as far as the protections that are available with a vaccinated population, because you don't tend to see these 4%, or in California it was on average about 3.1% of kids that were opting out of vaccines, because what you tend to see is it's not spread evenly across a state, it clusters into much smaller communities or schools, districts. And so what you'll have are these highly concentrated areas where you'll have 30%, 40% or higher unvaccinated populations that are highly susceptible to a rapid spread of vaccine preventable illness. And in other places you'll see 1%. And so so it's the fact that this is not evenly spread around that creates more opportunities when a case like measles, which all of our outbreaks of measles over the last 15 years are imported outbreaks. So they come, somebody was exposed in another country, flies back into an unprotected pool of people, and then that leads to the spread. What we happen to have here in California in 2014-2015 was the vector turned out to be a place where people come from all over the country and all over the world, and the exposure was there, and then they went back to wherever they originally were from. Whereas the year before, in Ohio, we had a vaccine outbreak that was twice the size of the California outbreak. Heard nothing about it because it happened in a rural Amish community where over 300 people ended up getting measles. And so what we have here is we've got Hollywood, we've got Disneyland, we've got people going all over the country, so you never know where it's going to pop up next. So all of those things make for a much bigger news story than a small, largely isolated rural community in Ohio. This is a couple different ways that vaccination has been encouraged through public campaigns, through government campaigns and the like over the years. We see an evolution in this of how the messaging has been done. One of the things that I think is a big reality when we're having these conversations with parents with young children is most people have never seen the vaccine-preventable illnesses that we are protecting against. So back when you see it in the picture that's on the left side there, you know, everybody knew a kid in the community who had polio or was a post-polio survivor. And so seeing this in your community, once the polio vaccine became available, people wanted to say, we're going to protect so that this doesn't continue to happen here. In the 70s, we had, you can see the Star Wars theme. You're connecting up with some sort of celebrity and things that would appeal to kids and that kind of a thing. Not the coolest Star Wars characters, if you were to ask me. I'd rather see, you know, Han Solo got his shot first or something like that. But the interesting thing is the language here is just it's very presumptive language. It's, you know, parents of Earth, are your children fully immunized? Make sure. And so this was again just kind of you have an obligation. The third is one that I passed this sign as I drove up here from Indianapolis to here to the conference, and we see this on billboards all over the place. It says vaccine-preventable diseases are just a plane ride away, and this one I think it's a really cool sign, but it is a fear-based message. I mean, you can almost kind of, it's like every horror movie you've ever seen, like something's going to jump out of that bag there and attack that child. I mean, that's just kind of, there's an implicit message that there's something spooky that's in there that could strike your child. And so so here we are starting to see a little more of this kind of fear as a motivator narrative in some of the public discussion. This is a chart that comes from a study that Tony Yang and I did earlier this year that was published in the New England Journal that looks at ways that different states can adjust how their law is structured and have an effect on vaccine uptake. There's a lot of different components that there. I have a citation at the end. If you'd like a copy of the article, I'd be happy to send you it. One of the areas I want to talk about are, or three of the areas I'd like to talk about as we go forward here are some of the things that have been found that are widely variable as states have been looking to adjust to their laws. Are the places where the arrows are, which are requirements of exemptions to be filed annually. Do they require that or not? Do they require an educational component to occur prior to receiving a vaccine exemption? This can fall into, on the right side there, it's what I've called an informed refusal process, if we're going to have this conversation, which I may need to reframe the name of that because, again, that's not a positive, constructive way of framing that. That's actually kind of a negative way of framing that. And then third is review mechanisms by the state. Does the state have any authority to, once you've sent in an application, to double check to make sure that it is, that the beliefs that are being purported to be stated in the exemption request are what are being followed by the family, is what they're adhering to as a family. The thing is, as I mentioned, this is a purely political discussion. The politics of vaccine law is it's very complex. It's very there's a lot of gamesmanship in the system, and so whenever laws are opened up, you know, from where they were before, new fun things can be inserted into them that can create very different outcomes. And that's what we found when we're talking about what legislatures are doing in this area. Oftentimes, the changes to laws come as a result of an anecdote. They can come as a result of a story that they hear from a constituent. They can come as a result of an outbreak, but what they don't tend to do is come with a deep conversation with public health experts before they put forward the legislative proposal. And so what we end up doing is starting is getting involved in these conversations after the fact, and trying to make sure that it can adhere as best as possible to best practices. But the laws can get changed up pretty. There's some very interesting ways that they've been changed up. For example, in Washington State a couple years ago, they were starting to see very high rates of exemptions. They decided to put into place an informed refusal process where people would have to go and meet with a healthcare provider before and have a conversation about the pros and cons of vaccination before getting an exemption. It used to be that in Washington, you would have to have that conversation with a physician. They changed the law as they made this adjustment, and they crossed out the word physician and they added in health professional, which in and of itself is not is not necessarily a bad thing, but you have to look at how they define health professional. And one of the groups that they included as they expanded to health professional was naturopaths. So a person can have a conversation, technically meet the definition of having a conversation about vaccine pros and cons with a professional who 90 plus percent largely vastly disagree with the whole concept of vaccination. It's anathema to their training. So what we're starting to see in the political process is that California had a very interesting year. But most states that have had success in changing or tightening their legislation have tended to do these things through regulatory processes. The State Department of Health deciding to change their regulations because they've been given broad power to protect health, welfare, and safety. They can make adjustments through administrative rules rather than having to go through both houses in their legislature and getting the governor to sign a change. And so one of the important things, as we've talked about HPV vaccination, Rhode Island, for example, this past year, just put into place an HPV mandate for seventh graders entering into schools. They have to demonstrate proof of vaccination upon entry into school that they entered in through their regulatory process rather than going through a legislative process. Georgia tightened up their regulations through regulations rather than through trying to get a wholesale change. Michigan did the same thing. So what we saw in California, again, as was mentioned, they had put into place an informed refusal law in 2014. But then they had this outbreak, and they decided at that point they wanted to get rid of vaccine non-medical exemptions altogether. And so they passed Senate Bill 277, and in June it was signed into law. This was not pretty. The process was very heated. And the politics were pretty vicious. Robert Kennedy Jr. Came and testified in front of one of their committee hearings and talked about the Holocaust that was being created by vaccination as far as vaccines and autism were concerned. You can see this is Senator Richard Pan, who was the key sponsor of the vaccine bill. This was a poster that was made of him. Down on the bottom right, we got 2 minutes. Wow. Okay, then I'll shut up soon. Down on the bottom right was spray painted in four different places around Sacramento and elsewhere. Actually, this is from the Beverly Hills Chamber of Commerce that said, "For every kid afflicted, a public figure will die." SB 277. So this was, again, this was a very tense discussion. So what happened in the public discussion? What we tended to see was a lot of sarcasm and a lot of snark. And this feels good, but I'm concerned that this is not particularly counterproductive. I really liked Amanda's the timeline that she showed. This is sort of like reinforcing, like that if you've already purchased, this is like reinforcing the good behavior. It's not necessarily going to get people who are leaning on the other side of the fence over to the other side. So what we also have seen as part of this process is this idea of choosing not to vaccinate being denormalized. And so the question is, you know, a lot of the public discussion about this, so the John Stewarts of the world and the Jimmy Kimmels and the like, that there was a lot of, that got a lot of social media play, were turning choosing to not vaccinate into a stigmatized behavior. And the question is how much should government agencies and public health professionals buy into that denormalization process as part of their narrative discussion. I'm about out of time on this, and there's a lot of other things to talk about. I guess if I could say the last thing, what we've seen recently over the last couple of weeks. Is reviving this discussion again, unfortunately, so that in a little bit later this summer, Maine had passed a law, and their legislature passed a law, but the governor ended up vetoing it, saying some parents, in weighing the information, choose not to vaccinate their children, and I believe those parents have as much right to their opinions as the parents who choose to vaccinate. This bill, which may force parents to add an otherwise unneeded visit to the doctor's office, could change the minds of parents on the fence, but it will solidify the opposition of some parents against vaccination. This bill unwisely leads the horse to water and tries to make it drink. So that was the official statement from the governor of Maine. In one of the more recent debates, we had Trump bringing back up a vaccine autism connection, and Dr. Carson being all right with the idea of spreading vaccine schedules back out again. So I think, one of the things that we're going to start seeing, just if I have one last piece, is I see this as a way that somewhat denormalizing is still part of that process. Information sharing, education, making information available to the public, using social mores as part of the process. What California is now doing and making available the vaccine coverage rates within schools and daycares available to parents, I think is something that is helpful. We may start seeing this in other places as well. In California, they're also going to add this for the employees and volunteers in daycares for the flu shot, as well as measles and whooping cough coverage. And perhaps we'll start seeing this as a metric with hospitals and healthcare workers with flu shots and things of the like as well. So there's a lot of different kinds of things, a lot of different angles. There's a couple of articles which, if you're interested in, I'd be happy to send to you. Just come up afterwards. But I look forward to your discussion and your questions. Thanks.